This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You got to be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You got to hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that.
Hey, everyone. It's Jason Hyland from the Sub 70 Podcast. This week's guest is Cliff Kresge, and it's a good story. He just got his card for the 2019 Champions Tour season, and that is a tough card to get. It really is. There's only four spots available. But it shows great perseverance, wonderful conversation with Cliff, and we'll definitely be rooting for him next year out there. But I hope you guys enjoy it. Give us any feedback or rating. And without further ado, here's Cliff Kresge. Well, I would like to welcome to the Sub 70 Podcast 2019 Champions Tour member and three-time Web.com winner, Cliff Kresge, to the podcast. Cliff, thanks for taking the time today to be with us. I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jason. Looking forward to it.
Well, first off, congratulations on getting what I think is the most difficult card in on any of the PGA Tours. I think it's four spots in the finals for Q School. So first off, congratulations on just getting that done and be able to play under that pressure and to get out there full-time next year.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I appreciate that. It was an emotional roller coaster out there, especially for my wife. But somehow, even though I was 4 or 5 years removed from, you know, any pressure situation like that, and I was pretty proud of myself the way I handled it, and I was able to come through and make some clutch pars and be able to make it.
Yeah, it kind of leads to one of my next questions I actually had here, and I know you haven't played a whole lot on the web in your late 40s like a lot of those guys do when they get ready for the Champions Tour. So how did you, you know, keep yourself tournament prepared to kind of get through the gauntlet that you got through? Did you play local tournaments, or how did you keep your game, you know, competitively sharp for that level?
Yeah. Well, a couple different ways. I did play, like, local tournaments. I played, you know, some little small mini tour events here and there. I played in our state open. You know, I try to play competitively with good golfers in the area, other pros trying to make it, things like that. I'm actually the assistant golf coach, the volunteer assistant golf coach at King College. So I stay sharp trying to compete with those guys and you know, just been doing whatever I could to stay competitive.
How many events will you think you'll get in next year on the Champions Tour? And then is there any of the Champions Tour majors that you are now exempt in with getting your card, or will you still have to qualify for some of the majors?
As far as I know, I'm going to have to qualify for all the majors. I think I'll get into between 17 and 20 regular season events. But all the majors, I'll have to earn my way in. As far as I know, I just was calling about an access sheet to see what tournaments I will get in and how I get into other tournaments. You know, all this is new to me, so I'm still not 100% sure.
And I kind of spoke about this earlier of how difficult that card is to get, and maybe our listeners don't know, you know, that exact process. So if you could kind of walk them through how many stages there are for your Champions Tour card, and then how many spots are available through the finals to actually get your card. I know it's really limited, but it's quite a process.
Yeah, okay, so there's two stages. The first stage is 78 guys, and around 28 or 29 guys advance to the next stage. And there are no ties involved, so if you got into a playoff for that last spot, you either made it or you didn't. And I think 3-under par played off in the first stage. And I was fortunate that I played well enough where I wasn't really in too much trouble. But believe it or not, I was 3-over after the first 9 holes in the first stage. And I was not doing very well. And I was fortunate to shoot 5-under on my second 9 holes to shoot 2-under par, which got me right to where I needed to be. And then I kept rolling from there. And then the next stage is the similar amount of people. Obviously, the strength of field got a lot better. And there's only 5 cards, fully exempt cards, that they give out at that round of Q School. And there is no and ties. So there were 5 cards and 5 cards only. And when we were looking at the scores, my wife was kind of watching it on her phone, and we were looking at the score and knew that 3-under was safe and 2-under was looking like a playoff. And it ended up being four guys playing off for two spots. So two guys were playing for a full year of exempt and getting in all the tournaments or most of the tournaments, and two guys were getting in zero. So that's a pretty pressure-packed playoff.
Is that where all of the years that you played in the PGA Tour and Web.com and winning at that level, do you kind of go back to that well of experience to know that you have won at a high level, you have been there? When you're when there's that kind of pressure playing, is that experience that you've had in the past invaluable for sort of getting you through those situations?
No question. Every time I had a shot that was any kind of crucial shot or something that meant a lot, I would go back into my memory banks of when I pulled it off, whether it was the PGA Tour or the Web.com or any kind of pressure situation. And I go, oh, I remember hitting this shot one time and I did this. And, you know, and so I was just trying to fill my mind with all these positive visions and thoughts, because in golf, there's a lot of negative feedback and you got to try and, you know, wash that away. And there were several shots on that backside that I was fighting the demons because, you know, I wasn't feeling great about my swing and I was hitting some loose shots and I was actually, you know, four times I had to get it up and down on the back nine to save par. And really that made the difference.
And that golf course for the finals, I don't know how difficult the first stage was, but the finals was playing. I mean, if you look at the score, it's really hard. I mean, Gibby Gilbert, the third shot, four under par to win it. Golf course have a feel of almost like a major championship? Because a lot of the Champions Tour events, you know, you got to go low quick out of the gates from talking to those guys. And you know, you got to shoot a lot of birdies. But yet for the Q School, they had this thing set up really difficult. And then does a difficult golf course like that fit your game? In other words, were you comfortable knowing that par is a really good score in any of these holes?
That's a great question. One, the first 2 days, it was quite cold for Florida. When I say cold, it was in the 50s and north wind blowing 15, 20 miles an hour. And so the conditions made the golf course that much more difficult. As far as the golf course in general, the greens had some nice speed to them. They were kind of quick, but they were fairly receptive. So if you hit a good shot, it was going to stop right next to the hole. Now, I liken this golf course. Off the tee, there were about five or six really key drives that you had to get in the fairway. For the most part, the fairways were fairly generous, and it became a second-shot golf course. And that's where it played right into my hands, because my iron game is my forte. I control my distance as well. I control my trajectories. And I felt comfortable with that kind of setup. And, you know, every day, really, I could have shot, you know, mid-60s, and I ended up making a double bogey or something stupid happened. I hit into water on a par five, and I kind of shot myself in the foot and put myself into that position the last day where, you know, I had to, you know, step it up and shoot good the last day. And, you know, I wasn't playing well the last day, but I was hanging in there. And that's the thing. When I said I had to make pars on, you know, I hit several not good iron shots for me that I had to result in relying on my short game.
So when you're going into a fourth round like that, when you're right there, you know you're going to need birdies, but you know you can't make doubles. And I know you guys like to play aggressive when it's the right number, or when, like I said, if you're a good iron player, you guys right. make birdies. It's what you do. But when there's so much on the line and the golf course is difficult, is it hard to know when to be aggressive versus when to shoot away from a pin because of the difficulty in the golf course and then everything that's on the line? Basically, you either, you know, you pass that test or you're not playing the Champions Tour next year. So how did your mindset, right. especially going into round four, sort of yep. assess the day or what you had to do?
Well, I started off the day with the same attitude I had the day before, which was to set a personal goal to shoot 4 or 5 under par. And I knew if I got to my personal goal, it would have taken care of itself with the five with one of those five spots. So that's how I've always pursued golf. You know, I know there's a lot of great players out there, but I can't worry about those other players. I can only worry about what I can do. And I knew I was capable of shooting, you know, 4 or 5 under on this golf course. And the last day, I had that same mindset of shooting 4 or 5 under. And I was hitting some pretty good shots and hitting a lot of fairways and a lot of greens. And I hit a wedge to about a foot on this par five, got me to one under. And then, you know, I hit a not so good wedge shot on the next hole and got above the hole where I couldn't stop it and had this putt where I knocked it 10 feet by and ended up making a bogey. And then I think I started thinking about things a little more, my swing, and then things were, I mean, there were some nerves involved. And I sure I made some tighter golf swings and hit looser shots. And I did the best I could to, like I said, rely on some of the past experiences and just try to make pars. Oh, that's the other thing I was going to say. My wife was telling me, or my caddy, you know, what the scores were. And some of these pin locations were in places where if you went for the pin and didn't hit it next to the hole, you're going to have a difficult time making par. And that's when I, you know, some of these times I wasn't aggressive and I just played for the side of the green, or I gave myself an opportunity to make a par, you know, in kind of a boring fashion because, you know, I didn't want to make bogey. I knew pars were doing it at this point. And the last four holes were super hard, and I knew making pars, I was going to be actually moving up. And that's why, you know, it was important to stay focused and make those pars.
It's impressive. It really is. Like I said, that's real pressure, you know, kind of playing for your career and to kind of come through when you needed to come through. I think all of us, you know, even amateur golfers at the level we play, I can still kind of learn from that of course management and how'd you assess the situation. But it's really good stuff, you know, getting it done when you needed to get it done, when the pressure's on. Next question I have for you is, how did you start playing golf and how'd you get involved in the game?
Okay, well, my folks moved to a golf course when I was about 8 years old. And it's a little golf course called Dubs Dread in pretty much downtown Orlando. And, you know, my mom was a school teacher. My dad was a truck driver, so we didn't have a lot of golf in our family. And but when I moved to that golf course, it was like my backyard. And that's where I wanted to spend my time. And so I just started honing my own skills. I'm a self-taught golfer. I was blessed with good hand-eye coordination. I played a lot of baseball growing up, but at one point I decided I was going to play golf, and I just went with it and just tried to work on it as hard as I could.
When was the talent there that you knew, you know, a D1 scholarship, you wound up, you know, playing golf at UCF? When did that start becoming apparent, and when did you feel in college you were good enough to sort of give the professional ranks a try and kind of test your game against the best in the world?
Right. Well, I think between my junior and senior year in high school, I was starting to shoot even par just about every day, and I saw what other guys were shooting and doing, and I knew I was capable of playing college golf. And did I know I was going to go to a D1 school? I mean, I had some offers for D1 schools coming out of high school, but, you know, I didn't have the finances to play in all these nationally ranked golf tournaments to get myself any kind of credentials. So all I played was local stuff. So I didn't get many offers. I ended up going to a junior college down in South Florida for a couple of years called Indian River and played well there. And just, you know, we played some great golf courses, had some good competition. And then from there, once I graduated there, I went to UCF and played really well there. And kind of a bittersweet thing happened my senior year in college, where my sister, unfortunately, got killed in a car accident. And it kind of changed my attitude about, man, I need to take advantage of every day I have on this earth, and I need to really, really give it all I got, because you never know when it's my turn to go as well. And I think that changed everything for me, and all of a sudden, I was better at my short game, better at my putting, better at my focus, everything. And I became an All-American my senior year in college. I won two golf tournaments, lost in a playoff in another, and I was competing against the best college players in the country, so I knew that I could play at the highest level.
Then when you turn pro, what mini tours did you start playing? There has to be some great stories. I know from talking to a lot of the guys, they kind of look back at that period of time, you know, almost with a smile, in the sense of kind of proving yourself out there did a lot for confidence in their career to kind of take it to that next step. So how was the mini tour life back when you were doing it?
Well, you know, mini tour life is really not that much fun. you know, you're paying a lot and playing for pennies. And, you know, it's really about getting competition, seeing if you can compete under pressure, you know, if you can make a putt to make a check or make another putt to win a tournament or pull off a shot you need to do that. And, you know, I was doing decent. I wasn't doing great. And but I knew I needed to get better. But, you know, I went through Q school a bunch of years and wasn't very successful. The pressure just kept getting to me. And I couldn't make it out of first and second stage for the longest time. And then I think my 10th try, I finally got my PGA Tour card through Q school.
And then you know, you play the PGA Tour in 2001, not the result you want, mm-hmm. but you must have gained something out of it, because in 2002 on the web, you have, you know, a couple of victories, establish yourself. Did that first season on the PGA Tour, looking back, do a lot for your career, even though it wasn't the net result you wanted, but just to kind of get out there and see what the best in the world can do? Because you must have taken something from that to have that season that you had in 2002 on the web.
That's interesting you notice that, because my first year on tour, I was kind of green. I didn't really know what I was doing. I remember the first tournament, I made a long putt on the last hole to finish tied for fifth and made a bunch of money. And then I was playing pretty good in the second tournament out in Hawaii. And I said to my caddy, hell, it's easy money out here, man. Look at this, you know. That was the dumbest thing I ever could have said, because I didn't play good golf for the rest of the year. And lost my game, lost my confidence, lost everything. And I quickly tumbled down the money list pretty quick and lost my card. But I guess I made enough money to have status on the then Nike Tour, which is now the Web.com Tour, and went to Australia and New Zealand for a couple tournaments, and didn't have very success in the first tournament. In the second tournament, I remember playing a practice round, didn't have a caddy, had a pull cart. It was about 50 degrees. The wind was blowing 20, and the rain was coming in sideways. And I'm going, what in the hell am I doing out here? You know, this is crazy. I don't want to be in New Zealand in the rain and the cold. This is miserable. Anyway, so I think it was Wednesday afternoon. This is a true story. I was struggling. I didn't know where I was going to go, what I was going to do. My golf balls were going left and right. And I'm out there on the range trying to find something to hit the ball straight. And I always have this little roller deck of swing thoughts that I go through to try and use to, you know, hit the ball well. So I tried this one swing thought of swinging low and left as I went through impact. And it was blowing, I bet you, 15, 20 miles an hour left to right, just howling. And I started hitting these five irons like a rope, just straight out, and in the last bit it would fall to the right. Straight out and last bit, just fall to the right with the wind. And I just was in disbelief how good I was hitting it, to the point where I had to stop and tell myself, this is how you play golf. And if you want to play golf like this, you better be ready for what comes with it. And what I mean by that is success, attention, TV, people, everything. And I mentally prepared myself for what was coming next. And I knew it was gonna come. And like that tournament, I played really well. I went home and almost won this mini tour event. And then the very next tournament I played it on the web.com tour, I was tied for lead with nine holes to go with this swing thought that just kept doing it. And I basically eliminated the left side of the golf course, and I would just hammer my drive right down the middle, and it would barely fall to the right. And then I'd hit my iron shots right towards the flag, and I was either making birdie or tapping in for par. Golf became kind of easy. And then I won another tournament a couple weeks later, and then another one. And next thing you know, I'm leading the money list halfway through the year. And I just propelled that into what went into my 2003 season, where I ended up finished 10th in the U.S. Open. I played with Tiger at the Western Open and competed with him. And I felt like I could compete with the best players in the world.
And you played, you know, on the web a lot, you know, it's $1 million earnings on the web, $4 million in earnings on the PGA Tour. So you've been out there, you played a bunch of events, and it just kind mm-hmm. of falls into my question. Is the line very, very fine between both of those tours? And then is that line fine, almost like we were describing, of playing good professional golf versus great professional golf? Is it that minuscule?
I think yes, it is, and no, it isn't. I think the guys that are the best players in the world are exactly that. They're just that much better. They hit the ball further. They hit it straighter. They putt better. They chip better. They do everything just a little bit better. I think the fine line is between the guys that keep their card and don't keep their card. And that little, it's kind of like a revolving door of the same guys that come in and come out. Those guys are really tight when it comes to the difference in those guys. One shot here, one shot there decides your career sometimes.
When you played with Tiger, what was that experience like?
Actually, I'd have nothing but positive things to say about Tiger. He was super nice, super cordial. And what impressed me the most about Tiger, because I knew he was going to hit it far, and I played with a lot of guys that hit it far, but what impressed me the most was his distance control around the greens. And he made it look so easy because he never left anything short, and everything died right at the hole. Chipping, putting, it was just phenomenal how good he was around the greens. Never wasted a shot. Always got it up and down when he should have, made every putt he should have, and then some. And it was just the difference between, you know, 4 and 5, 6 shots a round. If you think about every round of golf you play and you never waste a shot with a 3-putt or a dumb chip or something like that, you'd be 4 or 5 shots better too.
Yeah, that's when he's on all right, when he's firing on all 8 cylinders. I mean, you probably got to see golf as well as it can be played, right? I mean, when he was on, especially in that era, you know, in the early 2000s, yep, it was something to behold. It's a cool experience you got to do with
him.
Well,
he actually didn't even drive the ball well. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but he didn't even drive the ball well that week. He was mad at himself for how bad he drove it, and he won by 5 shots.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Isn't that crazy? I mean, in his world, he won with his, what, D or C game, right? But still.
Yeah.
Crazy good.
Right.
Crazy good.
Right. Like when he had his game, that's when he won the U.S. Open by whatever it was, 17 shots or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a cool experience. Yeah. I got to see that up close. I also know in the last couple of years you've been doing some teaching. So my question is, how much have you enjoyed doing that? And is there any philosophies that you sort of really believe in that's worked in your game that you kind of transfer on to your students? Or what has your approach been to sort of helping us amateurs get to be a little bit better?
Well, exactly. Actually, the fact that I do the teaching helps reiterate some of the things that I believe in my own swing. And the things that I do with teaching is I think about two things. I think about the club being on plane and keeping the club face square through impact. And I try to work with people's natural ability to swing the club. I don't believe in you have to swing it exactly the same, because if you did, everybody on PGA Tour would look exactly the same, but they don't. But where they are similar is from hip to hip, and the club face being square through that area on plane, and that's what hits the ball straight. So I work with these, you know, when I work with the college kids, that's what I talk about. And a lot of the kids, it's the bottom line, is people either get under the plane or over the plane when they hit the golf ball. So I try to keep them on plane as long as possible with a square club face.
When you were on tour, did you work with any of the, you know, quote unquote, big name teachers, and did any of that sort of their philosophies sort of really come to the forefront, or was there anything that you really took from any of these guys where you went, wow, I mean, you know, that guy gets it and it's simple? And did you ever have that experience when you were out on tour?
Well, you know, I ran into a couple guys, but like I said, I'm a self-taught golfer. The guy I worked with the most was probably at Brian Mogg before I really ever got really good. He helped me a lot. But I spoke with David Ledbetter. I talked with Butch Harmon's disciples, not really him. Sean Foley, I talked to him. I talked to all the guys. But in my opinion, I still feel the same way, like I talked about earlier, about the club being on plane and club face being square. And with today's technology, you can see it. You know, it's right there for you. And I watch a lot of golf. I'm a huge golf fan. And even though I wasn't playing golf full time, I watch every single tournament. I know all the courses. I know all the whole. I know everything. And you know, so I use that for myself. And when I work with other students.
I also like to talk about the charity work that you've done throughout your career for aiding people with autism. And how did that come about? And then how rewarding has that been personally for you to be involved and seeing that sort of grow and doing the good that you're doing with it?
Okay, I'm glad you asked that, because autism is very close to me. My son, my only child, is on the autism spectrum. He's high functioning. They call it Asperger's now. But I think I firmly believe the reason why he's successful and where he is today is because we had early intervention. We found out at an early age, he was about 2 years old, and the doctor said, I think, you know, he's on the autism spectrum. And, you know, you need to do this, you need to do that, and blah, blah, blah. But I need to, you know, warn you, he might not have fine motor skills. He might not speak. He might not do this. He might not do that. Well, my son does all those things, and I thank the Lord that he does. But I really believe that it was because we had early intervention that changed his life. Say in 2008, my wife and I decided to, start our own foundation to help kids in this area, in the East Tennessee area, because there really wasn't a whole lot to offer. And we decided to, you know, use my connections with the PGA Tour and, of course, you know, befriending Ernie, because he's got a kid on the spectrum, really helped. And we launched the Crazy's Crew Foundation in 2008 and had an amazing, successful tournament with guys like Ernie Els. We had Vince Gill do our entertainment. We had David Frost and Mark Wilson, Chris Stroud, DA points. We had Johnson Wagner. I had all my friends from the PGA Tour came out, and we raised a bunch of money to help the kids locally here in East Tennessee.
It's fantastic. You brought up Ernie, and I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I know you're very good friends with him. And what has that friendship meant to you over the years, and what do you admire about him the most?
Well, that's a very good question, because I consider Ernie today's modern-day Arnold Palmer. He's one of the most approachable guys, likable guys, super nice, always cares about you and your family, always asks about you and your family, remembers everybody's name, like your wife's name. I mean, and that takes an effort, a personal effort for a guy to do something like that. And he's given a ton of time and a ton of money to his autism center down there in South Florida. And that's why all the guys that have come to play for him do it. It's because of him as a person. And they've all donated their time, and he's raised millions and millions of dollars all over the world to help fight autism. And, you know, I mean, I can't thank him enough, because he's helped a lot of people in that, you know, on that spectrum.
Fantastic stuff. Got a few more here for you, just sort of quick hitters and whatever sort of comes to your mind, let me know. So if you could have a foursome of guys, let's just say from the Champions Tour, since you'll be out there next year, you can bring three other guys. You're going to play for some money, have a couple drinks and nice dinner afterwards. Which guys are you taking, and what do you like about those guys the most that would make them, you know, fun to hang out with for a day?
That's a good question, but there's a lot of great guys out there. It's hard to just narrow it down to four, to be honest with you. But I'm really looking forward to seeing some old friends again. You know, I mean, I got texts from Woody Austin. I got texts from Scott McCarron. I got texts from David Frost. You know, I mean, I got texts from all these guys that, you know, hey, man, can't wait to see you out here next year. And, you know, I'd put those guys in a foursome any day and go play a round of golf with them, and it'd be fantastic.
What golfer had the most raw natural talent you ever played with over the years, and what part of their ability was just crazy good?
Well, I mean, obviously Tiger was fantastic, but I remember playing a round of golf with a guy named Carlos Franco. And matter of fact, he's some guy I can't wait to shake his hand again soon. And this guy was, he made me look like a 10 handicapper playing with him. And I had my tour card, and I thought, he hit it so far and so straight and made it look so easy. He was so supple. And the guy was just oozing with talent. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I saw him at the John Deere Classic once, you know, because he never practiced or warmed up, right?
Nope.
He hit like six balls on the driving range and then went and teed it up. I'd never seen anything like that. Yeah.
You want to hear my first encounter with him?
Yeah.
I'm supposed to be playing with him in the U.S. Open qualifier. We were outside of D.C., I think. No, we were in Memphis. And I said to one of the officials, I said, did Carlos Franco withdraw or did he get into the tournament? Because he had just won his second tournament of the year in New Orleans like 3 weeks earlier. And I thought, well, maybe he's, you know, exempt now and he's not getting in. Somebody's getting in for his place. And he said, nope, he'll be here. The group in front of us was on the tee, and he pulled up on the putting green.
Yeah, yeah.
Still hear me? Okay. Yeah. He pulled up on the putting green. He showed up on the putting green. He didn't even hit a shot. He hit a couple of putts, and he went to the first. We started on 10, and it was a par 3, and I think it was like an 8 or a 7. And he took a couple clubs, and he was just kind of gingerly swinging on the tee. And he hits this 8-iron on the first hole, you know, good shot right on the green, about 20 feet. The second hole, he's hitting driver off the deck to this par 5 and 2 and knocks it right up there on the green and goes on to shoot 65, 64 or something like that. And like I said, made me look like an idiot, like a chop.
Yeah, can you imagine the talent? Stuff. I mean, he's out there and he's really just God-given talent, right? I mean, he's not working hard at it. He's just sort of letting it flow. Utterly amazing.
Waiting out of bed, limber, he's like liquid Advil, you know? The guy just, I mean, he's got arms that are just going long and, you know, just, I mean, long. He's got almost like, he has like a backswing, almost like John Daly, not quite as long, but he's that supple. And, man, did he hit the ball far and pure.
Yeah, I mean, that's some talent. I watched in disbelief as like, wait, no, I just saw him leave the parking lot that's like six balls and he's teeing it up? What the, but, I mean, it worked for
kidding.
Him.
Yes, it
does. Flip side of that question, who's one of, all the years you're out there, who's one of the most underrated and not appreciated enough golf pros you played with? Like, people don't realize he's that good.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of hard workers out there, and I hate to just single out one guy, but, man, that's a good question. I remember playing with Jay Haas, you know, when I was a rook, you know, one of my rook early years on tour. And, you know, he doesn't have what, you know, this great, you know, mechanically sound golf swing, but man, he knows his game. He knows what he's doing, and he hits it right down the middle, and he's hitting it right towards the flag, and his short game is phenomenal. It's like, you just can't believe how good this guy is. He doesn't look like he, you know, he looks like the average dude. He's not in like tip-top shape or anything like that. And the guy was just, he was awesome. And what a gentleman he was too. He was a fantastic person to play golf with. And I was like, man, this guy's my hero, you know?
Best golf shot you ever hit under pressure?
Well, I'd have to say my first really big one was when I chipped in for Eagle to be an Aaron Oberholzer to win my first then nationwide tour event, and that was pretty exciting. Talking about full swing shots, I'd have to say at Bay Hill when I was playing, I was in contention to win that tournament. I actually finished third to Tiger in 08. And, you know, it was a series of shots, really. It was 16, 17, 18, the iron shots that I hit into those greens under that pressure were pretty amazing.
Sweetens Cove is kind of down in your area. It's getting all kinds of publicity. Have you gotten to go out there and play it yet? And if so, what were your impressions?
I have not played it. My stepson has played it. He said I need to. He said it's fantastic. And I don't know if they can get wind of this, but maybe we could have a little autism pro-am out there one day, and I'd love to do it. And I bring some of my friends and do it out there. I think it'd be an amazing event.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to. I mean, I'm hearing nothing but it's just fantastic. I've heard nothing but it's like the best nine-hole golf course in the United States. So I might have to get down to your area of Tennessee on the eastern side there and go see this. Last one I got, since we're talking about golf courses, what's your favorite three or four golf courses you've ever had a chance to play, and what makes the architecture so great?
Well, I'm fortunate that I spent enough years on the tour. We played some pretty amazing golf courses. It's hard to narrow it down to five, but if I was going to narrow it down to four or five, I mean, Memorial is where Jack Nicklaus tournament is really pretty special. For me, Bay Hill is really, really nice, being that's where I grew up in Orlando and watching my heroes play there. And then I was able to, you know, finish third there. That was obviously the high point of my career. I'd say that Quail Hollow in Charlotte is definitely up there. Places like Torrey Pines and Pebble Beach that have, you know, history and just the breathtaking views are just incredible.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you've been busy after the tournament and everything to come on and talk about it. But we'll be watching next year, and hopefully we can get you back on when you get that first victory on the Champions Tour. I'd love to be able to talk to you about it, of what that experience was like. So best of luck for next year, and we're definitely pulling for you.
Okay, thanks, Jason. No problem. Anytime.